I'm Tom Hall. This is Midday. Food deserts. In cities and rural areas across America, millions of people live without access to supermarkets and no access to fresh, healthy foods. One's food palate is shaped by one's environment. If your environment includes nothing but small corner stores, your diet may well be rich in processed food, which can exacerbate health problems. On Baltimore's West Side, nearly 64% of people live in that kind of environment. Emily Stubbs' new film explores food deserts here in Baltimore. Harlem Park activist Anthony Francis is featured in the film. They join me in Studio A. Plus, theater critic J. Wynn Russick reviews the Chesapeake Shakespeare Company's new outdoor production of Love's Labor's Lost in Ellicott City. Midday starts right after the news. Good afternoon and welcome. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for being with us. Perhaps one of the items on your to-do list today is to stop at the grocery store. You leave your office, you jump in your car, you swing past the store, and voila, dinner is served. There are about 50 supermarkets in the city of Baltimore and nearly 700 throughout the state of Maryland, so with a car and a little time, you won't have any trouble finding virtually any kind of food you feel like fixing or that the store has fixed for you. That is not the case for about a quarter of people who live in our city who do not live close to any of those stores and who don't have access to a car. For them, a trip to the grocery store is not a simple matter. My guests today are the director and the subject of a film called Deserted, which explores the issue of food deserts, areas that lack good choices for healthy food, and the people who are working to address this endemic and important problem. Emily Stubb produced and directed the film, which was screened last spring at the Maryland Film Festival. Anthony Francis is an activist who is the founder of United Urban Roots, which has, among other projects, converted vacant lots in Harlem Park into community gardens. They join me now in Studio A. It's good to see you both. Thanks for coming in.
Good to see you, Tom. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
And listeners, to be part of our conversation, you can join us here at Midday at 410-662-8780. You can drop us an email, midday@wypr.org. You can send us a tweet at @MiddayWYPR. You can also catch us on the WYPR Facebook page where we are streaming our conversation. So, Anthony, let me begin with you. In the movie, you tell the story of why it is this became an issue for you personally. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, long story, as short as possible. I am a transplant in Baltimore from Columbia, Maryland, Howard County. Graduated from Wild Lake. So in Columbia, I'm used to having village centers and access to grocery stores and things of that sort. Pretty normal. We got into the housing market in Baltimore. I ended up moving into one of our houses when the market crashed, so I had to learn how to live in the city. Once I got to Harlem Park, I realized it wasn't as easy as going to your nearest community grocery store or village center to get groceries, that there was a lack of food resources. I noticed kids coming out of school every day and going to school eating chips and sugary drinks and things of that sort. So then I noticed when I got to the grocery stores that were available, the food there wasn't even up to par with what I was used to. So out of my own frustration, eventually I had to get involved or be forced to eat myself rotten fruits and lack thereof.
And you had a car. I guess your car got stolen.
Yeah, so.
And so that exacerbates the problem mightily, doesn't it? I mean, if you've got to be walking to a grocery store, how far was the nearest sort of, you know, major grocery store, not one of the little corner markets from your house?
I believe 1.6 miles.
Yeah.
That's one way.
Yeah, that's a hike.
Yeah.
And on the way back, you're carrying food.
You're carrying, you know, and then again, I have to decide not what I need, but what I'm able to physically carry, you know, back home. I may need milk, but now I have to get a quart of milk instead of a gallon because I can't physically carry it. But I'm 35 years old and I see elderly ladies and—
And you're in good shape.
I'm in decent shape, you know what I'm saying? Yeah. So I'm struggling about a block away from my home. And I'm like, I can't imagine being an older gentleman or woman and a lot of disabled people in the neighborhood trying to get fed every day on a daily basis.
Yeah. And Emily, when you took up this subject, now that you've been studying it, and now you're, as I understand, you're going to try to, this is a short film that you premiered at the film festival in May. You're going to try to expand that into a feature that, that covers this problem nationally. But what have you learned? What's the scope of the problem here in Baltimore?
Well, I think it's important to understand that food is central to all of us. It's something that we all need to survive. It's something that we can come together and share. So for me, approaching this topic was important, and it was important to showcase all of those who are working so hard to try and bridge the gap.
Mm-hmm. And there are a lot of folks, in addition to you, Anthony, doing some interesting stuff. But before we talk about that specifically, the problem is multidimensional. Mm-hmm. And transportation is a big part of it, as we mentioned. So the transit system and the way that's set up, and Emily in the movie talks about folks in Cherry Hill who have to take two buses to get to the nearest sort of large store. That's a 45-minute, 50-minute peregrination. Yes. That's a problem.
Which was not an option in Harlem Park. Mm-hmm. There was, again, the grocery store being a mile, 1.6 miles away, you would think, okay, well, I'll be able to catch a bus. That's not far away. But from my house, there was no bus route that ran to the nearest grocery store, which I thought was amazing. You know,
and a lot of, and the same can be said oftentimes for access to healthcare,
absolutely,
access to all sorts of services. Just getting there is really, really hard. 64%, Emily, of folks who live in the 9th Councilmanic District here in Baltimore, which includes Harlem Park, 64% live in what's called a food desert. How is food desert defined for purposes of your movie?
I think it's important to recognize some distinctions when trying to put a label on this problem, because a lot of people call it a food desert, and a lot of people use the term food apartheid. And I think that distinction is important because a food desert implies that this is a biome, a naturally occurring place, when in actuality, this has been something that was designed, created by the government, and it didn't just happen. So I think it's important to make that distinction and understand where we're kind of coming from, the history of this.
Yeah, and there are 14 councilmanic districts in the city of Baltimore, and all but one are considered mm-hmm. food deserts, which is really interesting. Mm-hmm. Including some districts that have fairly affluent neighborhoods. Mm-hmm. I mean, Roland Park, there's some 20 in that councilmanic district, some 20% of the people in the district at large are not, you know, don't have access to food. This does go back to redlining. Mm-hmm. It does go back to lack of economic opportunity. And those things, redlining was a purposeful thing.
Yes, it was.
The federal government, local governments. And so folks need to be hip to the consequences of that.
Yes.
Talk about the gardens that you're creating in Harlem Park.
Again, another product of my environment and frustration. So we're, you know, a lot of construction and empty houses where I live, or abandoned houses. So when construction starts, they need a place to put the demo. And when the city, in my opinion, is not on top of certain areas, and, you know, they really don't care, or they don't come check up on these contractors. They dump where they feel like it. So they tell you to call 311. You call 311 for a month, and nothing happens. Rats, drug paraphernalia, you name it, sits there, and we have to look at it. I'm embarrassed to invite people to my neighborhood. So I decided to start cleaning it up. It literally turned into people coming out of their houses one by one and asking what we were doing. And we were like, we're going to just take over this lot and turn it into something that gives people hope, gives something for people to look at instead of blight. Because nobody wants to wake up every morning. You can't expect people to have a high in life, so to speak, if they have to look at trash immediately every day they wake up. So that's why it was very important for me to start cleaning it, beautify it, and keep it going, and to scoop up as many lots as I can. as well as empower people into ownership of this land. Because, again, what they try to do, well, it's not a bad program, but they want us to adopt the lots, which is great because they need to be cleaned up. But what happens is we take care of the lots for 3 years, and then a contractor comes and says, well, we want that lot. And then they say, oh, well, you guys just were adopting it. So all your hard work and 3 years of sacrifice goes out the window. So,
yeah, yes. That's something I wouldn't have guessed. I mean, are some of the lots that you're working with, you know, lots that, you know, a lot of people really got their eye on? They're yes. highly desirable if they're so junked up and if it's blight, as we have come to know it.
Yes.
That's interesting that folks still want to get their claws into it.
Well, they want to get their claws into it after they've seen that it's been cleaned up and taken care of by the community, you know, and then once the community feels like they have some ownership of these lots, so to speak, they're swept away, and there's nothing they can do about it because some millionaire or a developer wants the land, you know. So I'm in the process of trying to, even where our gardens exist, move those pieces of land into a land trust of some sort, or so that the neighborhood can retain
ownership.
So they're
protected.
Yes,
yeah.
sir.
Yeah. So, Emily, in your movie, you make it a point to show the multidimensionality of this issue, because it's not just about, you know, where the grocery stores are and where the bus lines are. You have little kids that you interview from one of the charter schools in town, from like the first to the fourth or fifth grade. They're cute as can be. And it's, you know, as they used to say, kids say the darndest things, but they mm-hmm. also say things that are incredibly profound.
Sure.
And one of them talks about trash mm-hmm. and it just how people just throw stuff down and no one cares, and how that builds this culture of not caring about the community. Trash is as important to this story as the locations of the stores.
For sure. I mean, from the start, I really wanted to see this issue from the perspective of children, because for kids that are growing up in areas where they don't have access to fresh food, how is that impacting them and what they know? They're very smart, and they draw connections to everything that's going on, especially Cyrus, who talks about trash, which I feel like lends its way into food, because at the end of the day, we're talking about respect of our community. And if people are, you know, discarding their waste on the street, that just translates into other aspects.
Yeah, I was interested. You have a guy you feature in a film named Eric Jackson. He's the founder of something called the Black Yield Institute, and he talks about how environment, the physical environment of the neighborhood, the physical environment of the store, those stores that have, you know, the security glass, and you can't actually walk down an aisle, how that shapes all sorts of things, including your palate.
In poor communities where there's the oversaturation of McDonald's and other fast food chains and convenience stores or what have you, because those are the types of businesses that work in those communities, they shape how people perceive food. In so much that when people think hunger, they think to go and get something, to go to the town center or the shopping center or to go to the fast food restaurant, the 7-Eleven. They don't think go to the garden. That's shaped by where you live, which is also shaped by what's available where you live and what's acceptable in terms of how to respond or behave as a human being within that environment. Our environments are socially engineered by politics, historically. And so because those kinds of stores operate in the community, it's the same communities that you're gonna find people dying early. You can't blame people for that. You have to understand that these are larger structural issues that have happened before my grandmother, your grandmother existed, and they continue unless we stop them.
And Anthony Francis, there's a heartbreaking scene in this movie where you talk about a little kid who has never been to a grocery store, doesn't
yes.
know what it's like to buy something off the shelf,
mm-hmm.
just is used to standing on the other side of the security
mm-hmm.
glass.
Yeah, there's and you know, that it's not just that one kid. It's even more sad thing. That is, it's more kids than you would think that I come across on a daily basis. You just don't understand that, you know, cucumbers do come off of a vine. You know, I have 54-year-old men who are amazed that you were able to grow food out the ground. They've never even seen it happen, didn't understand that it could happen. So that always amazed me. And again, the kids just seem to take pride in it and helping us with it and learning how to grow. And once they see it, you know, and they understand what good food looks like, like cucumbers and things that sort of actually good in the salad if you, you know, fix it up right then.
And this is happening in other places around the city, too. I know. Yes. I live in Reservoir Hill, just a block away from the Whitelock Community Farm. Mm-hmm. We've got Denzel Mitchell in Sandtown doing the Strength to Love 2 farm.
Yep.
It's part of the, you know, the whole Harris Marcus Center down there. So there are people, and the kids do get turned on.
They get excited.
Because it's exciting, to, you know, to plant something, and then they're impatient, but you got to wait a little bit. And then when it comes up, it's a cool thing. All right, we'll talk more about it on the other side of a break. Anthony Francis is a musician and activist. He's the founder of United Urban Roots. He's working on the problem of access to healthy food in Baltimore's Harlem Park neighborhood. He's featured in the documentary film Deserted. Emily Stubb is the producer and director of that film. We'll have more on food deserts and what to do about them after a quick break. 410-662-8780, our email midday@wypr.org. You can tweet us @MiddayWYPR. You can tweet me @TomHallWYPR. You can catch us on the WYPR Facebook page as well. Stay with us. Welcome back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. By the way, coming up tomorrow, it's the Midday News Wrap. We'll talk about Robert Mueller's testimony before two committees in Congress yesterday and other news of the week. Ryan Lucas, who covers the Justice Department for NPR, and Elaine Kmark of the Brookings Institution will be my guests. Plus, we'll have a mini concert from cabaret singer Mariah Bonner, who's appearing at Germano's Piattini in Baltimore tomorrow night. She's going to sing for us here in Studio A tomorrow here on Midday. If you've just joined us, we're talking about food deserts in the city of Baltimore, those areas of town in which access to healthy foods is limited. Emily Stubb is the producer and director of a documentary film called Deserted. She joins me here in Studio A, and one of the people featured in that film is also with us this afternoon. Anthony Francis has created Community Gardens in Harlem Park, one of Baltimore's historic neighborhoods on the West Side. He also serves as a food equity advisor on the Baltimore Food Policy Council. To join our conversation, 410-662-8780, our email midday@wypr.org, our Twitter handle @MiddayWYPR, and you can also catch us on the WYPR Facebook page. So Emily and Anthony, let's go to the phones to Tom in Mount Vernon. Tom, welcome to Midday. Thanks for calling.
Yes, good afternoon. I'm a disabled veteran, and I live in Mount Vernon. Mm-hmm. And I have to walk to the Eddie's grocery store supermarket on Eager Street. Eddie's is the only supermarket in Mount Vernon. The closest other one would be Maryland Avenue and 21st Street. There's an elderly person I'd never make. And also Chase House is a high-rise elderly apartment building. Many of the people that live there go to shop at Eddie's with their walkers and their little roll-along carts and whatever. And they've got plans to close Eddie's and build an apartment building there. And so this is going to create a real food desert region on Mount Vernon, because the people that walk the store will not be able to do it anymore.
Yeah, and Tom, you know, I can't swear by this, but as I understand it, there is the plans include an apartment complex, but also a grocery store on the ground floor. I thought Eddie's or some other store.
They're vague about that, Tom. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And also the time lapse between starting a construction and maybe opening a supermarket, whatever
true.
It is, it's so long it would just destroy the neighborhood.
Yeah, during that period, you'd have a tough time.
Sure.
Well, that's a good point. I appreciate the call. Emily, you do a number of maps in the movie that are interesting, one of which shows how long it takes to get from point A to point B when you need to go to a grocery store. But mapping is something that there are agencies. There's a group at Hopkins doing that, and you refer to them in the movie. Tell us about the data that is collected and how it's expressed in those maps.
Sure. So we spoke with Caitlin Miziazik from the Johns Hopkins Center for a Livable Future in the film. And at the Center for a Livable Future, they partner with the Baltimore Food Policy Council, who together they create a series of maps that look at the food landscape across Baltimore. And they do this report every 3 years. And they released their last one last year, 2018. It was the first year that they included council member maps, where they made it a little bit more specific. And because Johns Hopkins partners with the Baltimore Food Policy Council, they're able to do a more detailed and comprehensive look than other food policy councils in other cities. So we showcase that in the film because I think providing a visual, an aerial look at what this problem looks like across the city, more specifically in these neighborhoods, I think that's crucial in addressing the problem. And it's been really helpful for the Baltimore food policy in carrying out initiatives.
Mm-hmm. And Anthony, your work then with the Food Policy Council, mm-hmm. There's a food equity advisor from each councilmanic district?
From each district. We've been coming together for the last 2 years now, I believe. And we've been working and moving some legislation in this place to help the city and some of these corner stores, the non-parasitic corner stores that we like to call, survive. Because there is a difference.
Non-parasitic. Yeah.
That's the best term I come up with. But there are corner stores in the neighborhood that care. They come out their front door. They know people by the first name. Then you have the other corner store who shows up in their bins, does the minimal, trashes in the street, and then they go home to wherever they live and really don't put back into the neighborhood at all. They just make money from it. So that's what I mean by, you know, the good corner stores. We're trying to move some legislation and some monies and resources in place so that they can better serve the communities instead of serving chips and things of that sort, or, you know, only chips, so to speak.
Yeah. Councilman John Bullock, who represents Harlem Park in the 9th District in the film, talks about wanting to see more grocery stores. And every mayor I've talked to in the last, you know, 15 years has said the same thing. I mean, from Stephanie Rawlings Blake through, mm-hmm. you know, Sheila Dixon and Catherine Pugh, Jack Young, they all want to attract grocery stores. But the stores tell them that there's no market. There.
Yeah.
I mean, what did you learn about that? Because you're looking at this problem nationally too, Emily. I mean, grocery stores are tough to attract for any developer. What's the key? How do we do it?
That's a great question. I think it's hard because grocery stores are in it to make money, essentially. And as we spoke earlier about redlining and how these certain pockets were kind of created where economic status is a bit lower, just the grocery stores don't see it as profitable, and we need to change that mindset and say, look, everybody eats, like the councilman says in the film, everybody needs to eat. So it's important that we kind of step aside these, you know, preconceived notions about what mm-hmm. what grocery stores need to be and should be.
There's a couple of scenes in the film where a gentleman named Major Hogg with the Salvation Army talks about this wonderful grocery store up on 29th Street. It's at 29th and Barclay near Waverly. It's called Doing the Most Good, DMG, and it's a nonprofit Salvation Army grocery store. Is that the kind of thing that could serve as a model for the kind of thing? Because I know, as I understand it, you've purchased a building or in the process of purchasing a building that you mm-hmm. want to make a farm-to-table restaurant.
Well, yeah. Yes, I've purchased a building.
Mm-hmm.
And again, this is, in my opinion, a city with a very lack of resources, but then it's expensive to do business in, which doesn't add up, in my opinion. And from what I know, you know, the profit margin of most grocery stores is pretty much 1% to 2% on a good day, even in
right.
a profitable. So in Baltimore, where you have high theft and things of that sort, they simply don't want to hear it. And then you got to pay high city taxes because it costs a lot of money to do business here. So I did buy the building. It was running as a corner store, and I thought I'd be able to simply open it back up as a food entity. The city said no. It's no longer a corner store. It is now residential. So then I spent...
So the zoning got changed?
Yep. I had to fight the city for an entire year to get them to change the zoning so that we could have some kind of food entity over there. We finally got that overturned, and that actually affected other people who were trying to do the same thing. So I'm glad that happened.
Now, with the economics of that, because as Emily mentioned, the margins, and you've talked about it too, the margins are really slim.
Mm-hmm.
I know there are some folks who've tried some grocery stores here in town. There's one called the Apples and Oranges mm-hmm. Market, which is on Broadway over by the Great Blacks and Wax Museum, Broadway and North Avenue, opened in 2011, but didn't survive. I mean, they couldn't economically make it. It wasn't a nonprofit. I think it was, you know, made to be a profit-making venture, although they weren't trying to get rich. They were trying to employ people, and they were trying to make healthy food available. The kinds of barriers and the kinds of things that you're encountering, what's the solution?
Well, I think you got to question a city anytime Target doesn't make it. Target did not.
Yeah, up in Mondawmin.
I mean, you know, Target is a big entity. So for them not to be able to survive, I believe Shoppers isn't going to make it either, from what I've heard.
The Shoppers, that's in Mount Diamond Mall?
Yes.
That's right next door to where the Target used to be. Really? I have not heard that. Yeah,
I've heard it on the ground. I haven't confirmed, but I heard that they're at least struggling and were considering closing their doors. So I think we need to think outside of the box and maybe take on smaller type, not mega grocery stores, but smaller community serving grocery stores, in which I'm trying to do something, like, you know, collectively with the community to do. Again, if the lady on the corner can at least go in and get a loaf of bread, a potato, and actually make a meal for herself from these corner stores, then they're not such an issue. The issue is that the corner stores that exist are not serving the community healthy food.
Right, it's only processed food. It's only stuff in bags food. And cans and jars.
Yeah, so when I go to New York and things and I walk in corner stores and I see that they have produce, I'm like, it doesn't have to be a bad thing that's a corner store. We just need to revamp how we think and give resources.
And Emily, you're working in L.A. now and studying what they're doing in L.A. There's a convenience store sort of program that the city of L.A. is pioneering. Tell us about what they're doing there.
Sure, yeah. So this film, 20-minute film, it was kind of the start of this larger project that now I'm taking on, turning Deserted into a feature length that's going to look at cities across the country and how they're responding and finding innovative solutions to this problem. Because I think that's unfortunately what we need, other people coming in and thinking, how can I, like Anthony, how can I fix this?
And what are they actually doing in L.A.?
So what they're doing.
Who's coordinating it? Yeah.
Yeah, so the L.A. Food Policy Council, they have a program that looks at transforming pre-existing corner stores to help them sell and maintain selling perishable items, fresh food. And it's a really great program. They're on their second transformation right now. And I'm really excited to be a part of it.
And the folks who are working on with you cleaning up the trash, working on the garden, growing stuff. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's training and sort of education on all sorts of levels. It's like in our market, there's a little market near the Whitelock Community Farm, and they've started stocking some of the stuff from the farm in that little corner store.
Yes.
But so the owners of the store have to be educated as to what that means, because you're doing perishable goods instead of a can that could sit on that shelf for 5 years. And then the folks in the neighborhood need to get used to buying that stuff instead of the stuff in the, you know, the bags of chips and stuff.
And programs like SNAP, Balta Market, in which we require the corner stores to have a certain amount of gallons of milk, to have a certain amount of grains, have a certain amount of vegetables to be able to receive help from the city. We want to push the corner stores to be healthy, give them some incentive, and not leave them out to dry as well. There are some people out here who want to do good, but they are living by the skin of their teeth as well and don't have the money to lose on things that are not being bought from their perspective and, you know, in these neighborhoods.
My guests are Anthony Francis and Emily Stubb. We're talking about the movie Deserted and the issue of food deserts. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Our number, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wypr.org. Our Twitter handle is @MiddayWYPR. My Twitter handle, @TomHallWYPR. And we are streaming on the WYPR Facebook page. Before we go to the phones, we have an email from Aris who says, "What is just as incredulous is the city selling off the likes of Cross Street Market, Holland's Market, Lexington Market, etc. Where's anybody going to get reasonably fresh goods?" Now, selling off, I mean, there's a big plan to renovate Lexington Market. Cross Street, Holland's have been renovated. I know down over by the B&O Museum, there used to be a Safeway in Mount Clair, the Mount Clair Station Safeway. That didn't survive. I mean,
I believe that's where the Price Right is.
No? Yeah. And so now it's a Price Right. But you know, so stores do come and go. I mean, there was it used to be called AMP in Bolton Hill on McMeekin Street that then became it's not a ShopRite, but it's one of those places that doesn't have, the selection is helter skelter. Mm-hmm. You never know what's going to be in there. Mm-hmm. I mean, they get bulk stuff that nobody else wants. And so one day you can go in there and you cannot buy a box of pasta. And the next day you can only buy a box of pasta. But the things like the Black Church Food Security Network that Reverend Heber Brown does up on Belvedere Avenue, making things available, I think that's a great idea, where they are using church land, you know, the real estate that some of these churches have, and they're planting gardens, and then those congregants are able to get it. I think it's great stuff. Let's go to the phones to Carol in Baltimore. Carol, welcome to Midday.
Hi, thanks so much for having me. I was just driving down the road and happening to be listening to your program, and I'm with the Baltimore City Master Gardeners Program, and we are doing a Charm City Farm and Garden Tour. It's a bike and a bus tour this weekend, and the United Urban Roots is one of our stops on the bike tour. So Hello. We just wanted to let people know that there definitely is a movement going on in our city, and what we like to do is try and do the same as the movie that you're promoting right now, showcasing the work that the urban farms and community gardens are doing to help band together to create sustainable solutions and heal food deserts while beautifying neglected neighborhoods. So I just wanted to thank you for doing the show and let you know that we're doing that this weekend, and we're meeting at Rawlings Conservatory on Saturday. We still have tickets available.
Terrific.
Too.
What time?
So for the bike tour, registration is at 8 o'clock at Rawlings Conservatory. Everybody can meet there and park there. If you're on a bike, of course, you're going to go on your bike. We also have a bus tour that will be registering at 8:30, same location at Rawlings.
Great.
And we will go all around the city and cover all the topics you're talking about in your show.
Great. Well, thanks for your work with the Baltimore City Master Gardeners. So the Rawlings Conservatory up in Druid Hill Park, right near the zoo. So, Emily, there are movements, you know, afoot all over the city.
Oh, yeah. This is a very hot topic right now. People are waking up. And, I mean, the goal in making this film was to start a conversation. I just think more people need to be talking about and aware of this problem because it's important. And I think Baltimore, just want to throw it out there, that the Baltimore Food Policy Council this past month, first time that the city has ever given them money to actually implement the solutions and the initiatives that they're working on. So that's huge.
Mm-hmm. And there are more and more urban gardens popping up all over the place. Rooftop gardens down in Fells Point and yes. Federal Hill. You know, Sandtown has a bunch of rooftop gardens as well as, you know, urban gardens. Let's go to Joy in Baltimore. Joy, welcome to Midday. Thanks for calling.
Hi, thanks for having me. I appreciated that you brought up the changes in Mondawmin. And as someone who lived in the city but has sort of the privilege of choice of where I spend my money, both for groceries and other goods, I think it's also really important to keep in mind, you know, that adding these types of food options and places, even in food deserts, also could attract consumers who might not be beholden to that neighborhood to shop, but would intentionally choose to spend their money in a way that supports the city. And now that those changes have come to Mondawmin, I have the choice now to either go to Canton Crossing, which, you know, clearly is a different economic model, or to Towson and spend my money in the county. And so I think it's really important for businesses to also remember that the people that do have mobility and have choice of where they spend their money and want to support the city are willing to do so and willing to spend their money in the city, but they have to make those options available in the same way that people who that might be their only option, are also looking for those resources. So there are people willing to spend their money in communities as an intentional choice to support our tax base and support the programs that money supports. But those options are also being taken away.
Yeah. Well, thanks for that comment, Joy. I appreciate it. Mondawmin's a really interesting example. I mean, it's sad news to hear that the Shoppers, the grocery store, may close there. I mean, I have not heard that.
Yeah. And another point, just real quick. The thing that's even more sad is even the Target existed. It was.
And they had food.
Yes. But I said, so I pick up a bag of croutons and all the croutons fall on the ground.
Mm-hmm.
And that's because the bottoms have been bitten out by rats. And where in the country does a Target exist that is rat infested besides Baltimore? That is my question.
Yeah.
You know, this is a big time entity. So this is the things we got to question. Even when we have resources, our resources are lack thereof.
What do you think should be, Emily, if you were queen and could just, you know, dictate, what do you think should be in that space where the Target is? I know Mayor Pugh, when she was in office, thought it would be good to have a movie theater or some entertainment thing. I disagreed with her vehemently on that.
I mean, we need more food outlets, whether that's grocery stores, small markets. I think we need spaces where it's accessible. And I think, I mean, if we really want to get down to the root, we need to reverse everything that redlining created. I think we need to take it a step further and, like, really dig deep into our history and acknowledge that that's what's happening.
Because Mondawmin is a transit hub. Mm-hmm. There's a gazillion buses who stop in Mondawmin every day. Every 10 minutes, there's another busload of folks. So getting to the, you know, talk about access. Access is not a problem in Mondawmin. I mean, from a lot of places in the city.
Yeah.
It's just such a waste that that it's not there. I mean, the MVA was over there for a number of years. Now that's like a Marshalls or something or a discount clothing place. But, boy, it just it really matters. And as I understand it, the TGI Fridays that's in Mondawmin is like for a while was the only sit-down restaurant in the entire zip code. Now, that's not true anymore because Bolton Hill has some restaurants, you know, which is in the same 21217 zip code. But, you know, to have, I mean, you're talking about building a sit-down restaurant in Harlem Park. I'm sure there's plenty of folks who say you're nuts.
Yeah.
You can't make any money on that kind of adventure.
Yeah, we a lot of the projects I've taken on have been called nuts because it's not about making money. We plan on giving back more than we keep. It's about showing people and empowering people that it can be done. We can own in our own neighborhoods. We can work and make money in our own neighborhoods to some extent. So it's more about the lesson for the people I'm surrounded by, more so than me making money off of it. I just want it to succeed.
Let's go to Jane in Baltimore. Jane, welcome to Midday. Thanks for calling.
Hi. Yeah, I wanted to mention a really good resource. The gentleman had talked about wanting to form some kind of community land trust to make sure that developers don't take over well-developed food-producing places. And there is a thriving and very innovative organization, a nonprofit called Baltimore Green Space, which has down pat the legal mechanisms to take over community gardens or food-producing places and permanently have them, you know, in legally so that they cannot be taken over by profit-making enterprises like developers.
That's a great suggestion. Thank you so much, Jane. I appreciate that. And Emily, when it comes to the other dimension of this, which is the perception of crime in these neighbors, now we have a perception of Baltimore in general as being, you know, a very crime-ridden city in neighborhoods all over the city, not just, you know, on the east side and the west side, where traditionally, you know, they've had some very rough times. How does that play into this whole calculation about food deserts and, you know, stores' willingness to locate their locations in these neighborhoods? What have you learned?
I mean, I think it's all about perception. If you think something's negative, it's going to be negative. But if we understand, if we look past that, we'll come to understand that these are real people and it's not all what the news makes it out to be.
Yeah, and there's a scene in the film, Anthony, where you talk about people's notion of what's happening and what's actually happening is very different.
I've lived there in Harlem Park on the west side for over a decade now, and I know all of my neighbors. We all speak to each other. They're all safe. No one I know has personally been shot or died. And we all live normal lives, even some drug dealers, so to speak, who are nonviolent. There's a very small group of people in Baltimore who are violent, and they're at war right now, in my opinion. And most of the neighborhood knows that's what's going on. But, of course, the news, you know, they just spread it over West Baltimore. But there's a lot of people who want good things.
Yeah, but the perception on the ground is a lot different than the perception.
Oh, most certainly. I can walk in my backyard and not get robbed. I haven't had any issues besides my car being stolen. But even then, that was from an outside neighborhood, somebody who wasn't from the neighborhood.
Right.
So,
Emily Stubb and Anthony Francis, the film that explores the problem of food deserts is called Deserted. It premiered at the Maryland Film Festival in May, and it's going to be screened at the Global Impact Film Festival in Washington next month. We'll have a link to it on our website, wypr.org/ Midday, and it has been nominated for Best Student Documentary at that festival. So congratulations. You're a graduate of Ithaca College, my alma mater, high above Cayuga's waters. And Anthony, you even did the music for the movie. So you're all over this thing in all sorts of ways. Well, thank you so much.
Thank you.
And best of luck to you.
So
appreciate
much.
You coming
appreciate
in.
Appreciate you.
Quick break. When we come back, theater critic J. Wynn Russick reviews Love's Labor's Lost, the summer offering at the Chesapeake Shakespeare Company. I'm Tom Hall. It's Midday. Stay with us.
This is 88.1 WYPR.